Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Spanners. Ready? We're doing things a little bit differently this week. This is a pre-record. There's no live stream because I will be on a beach in God's own county. That's Essex, England. And in this show, we will bring you some news. We're going to be talking to Catman and Christian about the latest comings and goings in Formula One. We're also going to do a tech segment where Matt will catch up with Matthew Summerfield, Deputy Chief Technical Editor at motorsport.com, and we'll be addressing some listener feedback, because boy, we've had a bunch. And we're also going to catch up with Chris Stevens as well to talk about LGBTQ visibility in motorsport and the Aston Martin Racing Pride Initiative. But to kick off, I'll introduce you to my friend and co-host, Matt Drumpitz. Hello there, Matt.
Hello there, Spanners. I must ask, will you be having the typical British beach weather of overcast, raining, and howling winds? Or have you programmed something differently for your visit?
You always roll the dice in the UK, but at the moment we seem to be in the middle of heatwave after heatwave, so I am hoping for paradise on earth, which is North Essex. I think this week we're going to be talking a little bit about the stuff we missed in Baku, and I think the main thing I missed about Baku on our race review last week, and I'll forgive us because we do it immediately after the race, so we're getting a kind of raw impression on a Sunday evening. If you want to listen to lazier podcasts that wait till Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, then yes, they've had a chance to let it all simmer down. But now it's simmered down for me, Matt. The main thing is how delighted I was that Red Bull was out ahead with two cars and Lewis Hamilton was struggling to get by them. Isn't this everything we've wanted as F1 fans, a competitive top of the grid?
I do believe we've waited roughly 7 years for this scenario to present itself. And now that it finally has, we're going to change all of the rules for next season.
But even when it was Vettel challenging Hamilton, it was still two Mercedes versus a Ferrari. When it was Verstappen, it was one Red Bull versus two Mercedes. To see that flipped around was just wonderful. And you see Lewis Hamilton and Mercedes now at the edge of their comfort zone.
Yeah, well, and this answers, I mean, we've seen Lewis win championships. We've seen him come close. But there's no way anyone's taking this one away from him if he wins it this season, because he will have won it, not the other teams have lost it.
We are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. Bringing some class and grace and style to Missed Apex Podcast is Chris Catman Turner. How's it going, Chris?
Good. I assumed you were talking about our other guest there. That doesn't describe me at all.
No, I subverted everyone's expectations. You're a handsome man. And not only that, Mr. Turner, you're also a captain of industry. You own your own business. And I've often described you as the only true grown-up on the Missed Apex podcast panel. And I don't want to distract away from Formula One. I just want to make this quick note, because you're a professional vet. If you ever find yourself on an alien planet and you're ill, you shouldn't ask for their culture's doctors. You should ask for their culture's vets, because they're used to treating a wide variety of species.
That's true. But if they ask you to take their temperature, just politely decline.
Roger that. Right, let's move on to our next guest. It is broadcaster, DJ, commentator, and all-round man of wisdom, Christian Pedersen. How's it going, Christian?
Good evening. Now, I have a question for you, Spence.
Oh, I'll answer it.
It's been bugging my mind, I think, since Monday. It was on the last podcast. You were heard saying, did the Death Star have a commander?
Oh, okay. I don't really know Star Wars, so no, I might have messed that up.
So who's Darth Vader?
The main bad guy.
The Death Star commander.
Oh.
It's important you know this. You have kids.
You could argue it's the Emperor, actually.
Yeah, okay, true. Let's not get into the details, Chris. What's going on here?
That was all from me saying that in my F1 fandom, Ferrari has always been the Death Star. And when I talk about Vettel having been the bad guy, Schumacher being the bad guy, that is all just in context of me as an F1 fan needing that enemy, needing that opponent to play against. If you're playing a game of football, you need an opponent. They can't just be your best friends in a boxing match. You would want someone to come at you so that you can fight them, Chris.
Isn't that really hard, though, when they've got the lovely Charles Leclerc and Carlos Sainz, both excellent, lovely people?
I know. Ferrari are totally ruining their Death Star image with two of the most likable drivers on the grid.
And as we all know, the best way to ruin your Death Star image is to not win for like a really, really, really long time.
Yeah, and there will be generations of people growing up now where Mercedes are the Death Star.
And actually, you need the Death Star to make it exciting. So if you have black, you have to have white. If you have light, you have to have darkness. And every time there's a big manufacturer winning all the time, they automatically become the Death Star.
The three-pointed Death Star in Mercedes'
case. Yeah, true.
Fair enough. All right, let's get to a Baku roundup. I think, Matt, we did obviously cover the red flag and the safety car stuff, but Adam Rosales in our Patreon Slack group asks, could you talk about the safety car delays and race director decisions for the red flag and the safety car? I thought that the red flag was wrong at the time. I may have softened on that slightly, but I still feel, this is my main argument, I still feel that had the race directors had no knowledge of the lap count, so if they didn't know whether it was lap 67 or lap 42 or lap 80, then naturally they would have cleared the debris, they would have let the cars unlap themselves, and then the race would have finished without their knowledge. So to me, what they did was an unnatural decision, and I don't think I'm wrong or unfair when I say they deliberately made that decision for the interests of the sport and the viewership.
Well, I think had they made the decision, the debris would not have even been cleared before the checkered flag was flown. So yes, I agree with you there. It was very clear, and Mazzi admitted as much in an interview, that as soon as we saw it, it was clear we wouldn't be able to clean it up before the end of the race. And all things being equal, we felt that it was better for everyone to finish the last two laps under competition, under green flag competition circumstances, rather than just run everyone home in the safety car.
Catman, it's Americanism gone mad, showmanship over sportsmanship.
Oh, but it was fantastic end to the race.
Yeah, I know it was, yeah. No, don't get me wrong. I'm a shallow fan as well. It was super exciting. I'm just saying, like, it's organic.
You could say that actually the first safety car was the inconsistent decision, given the decisions they made at Mugello last year, for example, where they had a couple of red flags for debris on the start straight, and it took a while to clean it up. So actually, you could say that flying the safety car now for that sort of incident is not the correct decision.
I would absolutely 100% beg to differ, and I think Christian will agree with me. The main reason you weren't going to see a red flag there is because Stroll had parked the remnants of his car in such a place that no one could actually access the pit lane. So they were a bit they were a bit hung out to dry with regards to that.
I'd also like to argue that when it was introduced back in the days, the safety car, no, the restarts during a red flag, everyone was, yeah. Everyone I've talked to about this race was, yeah.
Yeah. And
still, we are here sitting debating if it was a good thing or a bad thing. I think sometimes we need to cut them some slack, because I don't think we saw any unfairness during the I'm not saying you guys are after them or anything, but we didn't see anything that was directly unfair.
Okay, so what we're saying is that the restart wasn't to benefit one side or the other. It was with the thought in mind that we didn't want the race to finish under safety car conditions, because that would have been a disappointment. Let's make the decision as early as we can. Let's stop it and have two full racing laps left. So in that regard, you can see the intention, and it worked. And this is why I'm struggling, Catman, because it worked, and you're right. And Christian is right. Ah, that's what everyone did. And the restart was exciting and dramatic. But we can just admit that it was for that reason. And that's okay. But that is one out of 10 steps towards sprinklers, isn't it? Isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think if you were to make the same decision again, or have the same position again, I would love for them to make the same decision again.
No, if you're throwing a safety car just to close the field back up because, Nikita Mazepin brushed the wall, we're going to throw a safety car so we can clean up what might be a shard of carbon fiber on the track. Okay, now you've gone full NASCAR, and that's a different story. But there was every reasonable choice to be made to red flag it so that we got two laps of running at the end versus just finishing under the safety car.
So you were talking about the decision to throw the flag early. So what about actually getting the safety car out early? Because a lot of the drivers complained that the safety car wasn't there quick enough.
I'll just add that when TV got colors, some complained. So there's something called evolution. And I think Liberty is doing it really, really well. Considering what you see on American TV, if you watch an IndyCar race, that's like, this is the Chevrolet Cam brought to you by Heineken in a Budweiser vein. I mean, it's just hilariously bad. And you have a commercial break every 5 minutes. So what they're doing is very toned down, and it works. So, I mean, hats off.
And we went a little bit down that path with the little studs at the bottom of the car. What are they made out of? I've forgotten. The ones that make the sparks.
Titanium.
Titanium sparks. Weren't they?
That's a little bit.
They do nothing. No, shut up, old man Pedersen. They are amazing. And
blame Liberty for that, though. Was it before?
Yeah, I remember the first time they did it, my son went, whoa! And it got his attention. And I was like, yeah, they do look pretty cool.
It used to be tungsten, I think, because they were heavier. And before that, it had been titanium. And then Bernie was like, I like the sparks that I saw. And some other thing, maybe it was the Nürburgring where cars were on their sides generating sparks. I don't really know. But he said, I want that back. And so
sparks were mega. And it lets you know the undulation of the track and the bumps that you're dealing with as well. So not completely useless.
It does look cool.
Yeah, it does. You'll have to remind me what we were talking about, though. Oh, yes, the safety car decision. The thing that came out of that was the McLaren engineers complaining about Yuki Tsunoda, Matt.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. Now, everyone's like, why did it take so long for the safety car to come out? And I don't really know the answer to that. I haven't seen an interview where he said, oh, it was X, it was Y, it was Z. But here's what I do know straight away, is that the sector where the crashes were covered by double waved yellow flags. And the wording for double waved yellow flags is slow down and be prepared to stop.
Yeah.
Now, I know Formula One cars stop really fast. So it's so like from I'm driving my family sedan point of view, it can be a bit hard to judge. But I'm not convinced all of those cars were going slow enough and were really prepared to stop if they needed to.
Did you watch Julian Palmer's walkthrough where, I mean, Tsunoda and was it Gasly? I think they didn't lift at all. And also, they drove past just immediately afterwards, and maybe they didn't have time to react and stuff like that. But the fact that nothing happens from this on the fastest track at all, I think is a little bit strange.
It is. Now, in the past, Formula One set out a formula for the mini sectors. You have to slow by X percent per mini sector, or you will not be considered to have respected the double wave yellows. But I believe that even whatever percentage they set still resulted in what sort of everyone considered to be quote unquote dangerous conditions. And Mazzi himself said, I felt like the whole field was going too fast. Like, I know you're pointed at Tsunoda. So yeah, I'm thinking it's going to be a real interesting driver's meeting at Paul Ricard about this.
So this is why I got upset on the race review about the radio between the team and race director being broadcast. Now, like everyone else, I thought it was a brilliant thing, and for entertainment, it's great. But as soon as we saw that argument between McLaren and Massey, you suddenly realized the danger. So the McLaren engineers basically forced the hand of Massey to make an on-the-spot public decision. And his decision was, no, nothing about Yuki. Everyone's bad. I will mention it in the race brief later. So even now, when we see the telemetry, pride starts to take a place in there, Christian, because Massey, his professional reputation is on the line because it's broadcast. His snap decision is broadcast. And he's now got to stick with his original decision that everyone was equally bad, even if we can see traces that Tsunoda was much worse than, say, Norris, who you can see on the graph, the graphs I've seen, lifts entirely. So the McLaren guys were kind of right to go, well, Norris lifted and Tsunoda didn't. But now Massey's got to double down because he was publicly called out on it and he's had to make that decision in the open.
I think we've seen some strange, messy decisions generally the last year or so, but we can talk about that another time. In this specific situation, I think it highlights the what goes on inside the head of a driver, because we've all been karting. We know when the yellow light comes on at the rental karting track, we have to stop, but we don't really stop. We drive half a meter more, and we just get a meter. Yeah. And that is because that is the mindset of racing. So you have these 20-year-olds driving around with the mindset of, I'm going to be faster than anyone here. And that is the constant feeling in his head. And then suddenly he has to slow down. There's something wrong in that situation. So I think if we could do something like maybe downgrade the power in sectors where there are yellow lights or something like that, that would be much easier, because it's a very different situation, a difficult situation to handle for Massey, I think, this one.
Interesting. And as always, if you have any direct response to what our panel are saying, feedback@missedapex.net. We love hearing from you. You can also email me, spanners@missedapex.net, or Matt directly. You can bypass me altogether. Matt@missedapex.net.
Yeah, so first off, I'm really glad that we don't have Brad and Alex on the show.
No, they'd be arguing
about the kart race we had 3 years ago still.
Yeah, and the thing is, all they're doing is talking about who cheated the least. They were both terrible under yellow flags.
Yes, but this again brings up my curiosity as to how they're measuring compliance with double-waved yellows. Because if they're measuring it by sector or by mini-sector, the fact that Tsunoda didn't lift by Verstappen doesn't necessarily mean he violated, quote unquote, the rule, whether it's written or simply been conveyed to the drivers. And I think it just brings up the difficulty, because these cars are so unnatural in how fast they are and how they drive and how the drivers want to drive them so they stay competitive. Normally you just say, oh, hit the pit limiter when you're in double wave yellows. But then immediately the argument is, well, that's going to be unfair if that flag is lifted when my opponent has just made up 10 seconds in the sector before that.
Christian?
I'm thinking. I think Matt is right, but I'm not sure this is a thing that can be handled by the drivers entirely if we want the best races. We should have like torpedoes in the cars, and we should say, now you can't go fast. Go fast again. We can let them decide.
Catman.
They do it in the WEC with the slow zones that they employ. So they have a slow zone on the track. Admittedly, quite often they use much bigger circuits than Formula One, but they have to reach the pit lane or the slow zone speed limit by the time there's a specific line they have to hit it. But as you say, it's always open to abuse, or when it's opened up, then they can lose time to compare to their employer, their competitors.
In general, I think Christian is right. The last person drivers should trust with driver safety is drivers. It seems like Mazzi thinks there's a bigger problem here to be solved, and I look forward to see what solution he brings.
Excellent. Okay, guys, we've got another listener question. John M. asks, how bad are things going for Danny Ric? Daniel Ricciardo at McLaren, of course, the new teammate of Lando Norris, has made a little bit of a journeyman of himself. He's come from Toro Rosso. He's gone to Red Bull, then made that big money decision to go over to Renault, and has then from there gone to McLaren. We are six races in. It's not looking amazing, Catman. But is it as bad as it seems? I guess put it this way. There's a couple of scenarios here. Either he was always rubbish, Norris was always better than we thought, or he's now coming into his peak, or changing cars is just unreasonably difficult. Which is it?
I think the changing cars thing does take time, particularly with no testing. Some of them have managed to change quicker than others. And that all, I think, that really depends on how much assistance you're getting with that as well, and how hard the car is to drive. Because Perez came out recently and said that he's adapted much quicker than he thought he was going to be able to, because Albon, believe it or not, has actually been very helpful to him. So he's been putting in a lot of time in the simulator and sharing a lot of information. So he actually credited some of his victory to Albon, which I don't know if he was just being polite, but certainly he was saying that that actually was very helpful to him.
Well, Matt, I mean, you're a big Albon fan, and I know people are getting upset because they think, well, Albon would have been doing exactly as well this season. It's nice to hear that he wasn't vindictive about it, at least.
It is. And no, I don't think anyone would say that Albon would be having exactly the same results as Perez. Albon was a brand new baby driver. Perez is at the height of his career. You can't really say that you're going to get the same results. But what is good to know is that Albon still feels emplaced enough in that system that he's not withholding information, that he's telling Checo, look, this is what's hard about this car. This is what you're going to have to pay attention to. This is what always caught me out the most, so that he was able to prepare and do a better job. So in that sense, it's good to, I feel like Red Bull is kind of taking care of its own better now than perhaps they used to in the days of Alguersuari and Buemi, etc. Although, shouldn't say Buemi, he still works for them, but Alguersuari and so forth, when we would just see them booted out left and right for no apparent cause.
This was probably the best decision at all for Alex Albon, to stay with the team and just do the best, to be a great ambassador for himself as a racing driver, because, I mean, he didn't have many opportunities, but I think he chose the right path and he's doing an excellent job just being humble about it. I appreciate that. If you have comments to that, I have a thing about Ricciardo afterwards, but I'll just wait with it.
Yeah, sorry, it did start on Ricciardo, Catman, and you led us down the Red Bull path. It's all your fault.
It is all my fault, and I will bring it back to Ricciardo then. So you could say it's – so based on the team working aspect of it, is Lando being less of a good team player than he was with Carlos Sainz, for example? Because now he's not the rookie. He's got to be – he's got to establish himself as the team leader. He's had, what, three seasons now? So is he being less helpful towards Ricciardo to get him embedded, to make himself – look better? You know, these guys have got a ruthless streak about them. There's ways that you can hinder your opponent without looking too obvious about it.
I think Ricciardo was surprised that Norris wasn't, hey, he's my new best buddy here. I think he was surprised by not being in that group immediately. But if you look at it like at the pattern of Lando Norris, the first half year with the Sainz wasn't that great at all either. It takes time to I think, gain access to him. And on top of that, don't forget that Carlos Sainz actually told Ricciardo, this car is a drag. Just wait and see. And they're like blinking to each other. Yeah, you were right. So if you have a car like that where you totally have to change your driving style, it is going to take half a year. And I mean, already you could see some of the times he did in Baku, he did really well, I think. He's definitely progressing, and he's a very, very fast driver. When he gets to break with the McLaren car as he did in the Red Bull, I think we're going to see some changes.
And let's not forget, up until this year, Daniel Ricciardo has spent his entire life, as Summers and I talked about earlier, with a Renault power unit, and that change is not insubstantial in terms of a variety of different factors. Add to that the change at the rear of the car with the aero regulations and the fact that we have brand new front tires, which are really complicating things. And you begin to see why, of all the switchers, he's the one who seems to be taking the longest to get on top of his new ride.
Okay, so I'm going to be, unfortunately, the voice of the thing that makes email complaints flood in. feedback@missedapex.net. I think Daniel Ricciardo is in trouble. And I know I've joked about Daniel Ricciardo being secretly evil, so you might think that I'm anti-Daniel Ricciardo. I'm honestly not. He's a fantastic character for Formula One. However, the worrying thing is he keeps talking about being treated like a rookie. And he's putting a brave face on that, and he's saying, well, the team are treating him like he's a noob and just, you know, going back to basics so that he can get comfortable with the car. Combine that with the fact that there's every chance, Catman, that Lando Norris is a genuine superstar. Hashtag British bias. There is every chance that Lando Norris, in his, fourth year in Formula One, has gone from lovable caterpillar to very serious, indeed, butterfly. And the Daniel Ricciardo is just meeting a talent in a team, established in the team, and it could just be too much. My prediction here is that this season it's too much. He will not get up to Lando Norris's level this season. That's my call.
Yeah, and don't forget, Lando in his junior Formula won everything and dominated everything except for Formula 2 when he came up against Russell and he was a bit distracted by getting the McLaren contract. Has Ricciardo found himself in the very position that he didn't want to be in when he left Red Bull? He left Red Bull because the team was Max's team. He had a long-term contract. He was Max was everybody's favourite. He then moved to Renault to be Renault's favourite, but he didn't get on there. And so he's now jumped to McLaren, where their golden boy Lando has just signed a multi-year contract. They're building the team around him long term. Where does that leave Danny?
Where does that leave Danny, Matt?
Well, I think that leaves Danny having a very set period of time to figure his...
You nearly said a Leclerc/Verstappen bad word, and everybody would have been alarmed except the Dane Christiansen here. Christian Pedersen.
I've been called worse on this podcast, Benner, so...
I've called you Kevin before, haven't I? Because every Danish person is called Kevin.
I'm ready for it. I think McLaren is the right team for Ricciardo, and I think you underestimate the team spirit in McLaren just a little bit because it's new times there. Zak Brown is a great CEO. Andreas Seidel is really proving his worth right now. He came in as the silent one and now he's picking the fruits. And I think he has a lot of sympathy and...
Hang on a minute. Whoa, you're saying Seidel came in as the silent one. I mean, yeah. He's not exactly doing jumping jacks and karaoke renditions of My Achy Breaky Heart on his team interviews, is he?
No. Well, I think if you did, you would cringe. You would be like,
I want to see it. I want Seidel doing Billy Ray Cyrus impressions.
I don't think he's the type that should stay silent. He's doing a great job, I think. And I just think there's a great atmosphere in McLaren at the time, and I think he will benefit from that. And I think they're actually helping him.
Okay. I think, Matt, one last point on that before we shuffle up the grid.
Well, for me, it's always the woulda, coulda, shoulda. I think if I'm Ricciardo right now, I'm doing my best not to have any regrets when I look at the entirely changed leadership structure at my former team, and I look at the fact that I could have been the one crushing Alonso instead of Ocon.
Yeah.
And that just brings up to me the very interesting thing. Had he chosen to stay and Alonso came back, could we have seen the delightful pairing of Ocon and Norris at McLaren? Because I think that would have been its own special fun as well.
Excellent. Well, guys, as I mentioned earlier, we've got a Frankenstein show where we're stitching together a few different topics. So do stay tuned. We're going to have a tech time with Matthew Summerfield. We're going to have an experimental segment that may or may not appear. Like if we record it and it's terrible, we're just going to bin it. And we also will catch up with Chris Stevens as well to talk about an Aston Martin initiative too. But before we go to those things, I think we'll end to talk about we're talking about the woes at Mercedes, Matt, because am I stomping all over tech time topics here?
Well, I mean, no, because we won't talk about it in the same kind of excruciating detail. But also because some of the stuff we're talking about has happened since we recorded our segment.
And oh, okay.
The biggest thing to come out of Mercedes is they are now saying that they think they have a bead on the issue that's been plaguing them at Monaco and at Baku. And they think they may be able to engineer a fix for it. And we saw sort of hints of that in Lewis's turnaround. But by the time they'd sorted it out, it was the end of FP3 and really effectively too late. So they're saying that Lewis was even racing with a suboptimal setup based on what they understand now.
Okay, so they think they've got a handle on it. In that case, I think we'll leave that because it sounds like you've basically summarized that entire story. I will end on Matt in the chat room. Not in the chat room. We don't have a live chat today. Matt in the Slack group has asked, I think your whole panel should try to predict the results of the triple header coming up, and the loser has to have a forfeit. No forfeits, but we can give some wild predictions for the next three races coming up, which are the French Grand Prix and then a double header at the Red Bull Ring. So, first of all, I'll say, I don't hate the French Grand Prix as much as some people. I get that it's not a TV spectacular, but in its favour, Catman, in its favour, drivers do race at that track. They're not scared of binning it. They're not scared of gravel. They're not scared of going for a move because they can just go back on track. So as long as they can't gain an advantage leaving the track, from a sporting point of view, like, it's fine. They can race there.
Yeah, the track itself is okay. My eyes just go a bit funny with the off-track painting. But yeah, if they were, would it not have been a more interesting idea to do a double header at Paul Ricard without wanting to anger people? And they could actually have chosen different layouts, for example, and maybe tested something interesting.
Matt.
Yes. Well, along those lines, it's just come out that they were apparently looking at a reverse direction Red Bull Ring race.
Oh.
That I'm assuming on safety grounds, they've decided they can't really run. But yeah. Yeah, you're always looking for that alternate layout if you're going to be at the same track twice. So maybe we'll see different tire compounds. I don't really know.
Yeah, they wanted to...
reversed. Sorry, Chris. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I was going to say they wanted to do Silverstone reversed when it first came out in the pandemic, but then they decided, as Matt was saying, that the barriers were the wrong way around. So you can imagine if Max had hit the barrier in Baku, the pit lane barrier, it would have been the same at every corner around Silverstone if you're going the wrong way because of the places where the marshals have to drag the cars back into. They just have end-on barriers right there.
Exactly.
Christian.
Paul Ricard, I think, as a driver, I don't think it's a boring track, but the thing is for the visual presentation of the track. So from a viewing point of view, you have no idea what's going on. You just see all these dotted blue lines or these blue lines. No idea if they're following the right path or what. And I think that's the main problem with Paul Ricard. You could easily do that track and that race much more interesting by maybe painting the racetrack for that particular weekend in a theme, maybe a sponsor theme. Do something wild.
Just put big yellow arrows in the direction of travel when you get to the turn so everyone knows what's about to happen.
Yeah. something new, something fresh. And I think Paul Ricard has possibilities and actually great racing sometimes.
Okay, so there's three podiums. What I'm going to say to my panel is race one, one, two, three. Race two, one, two, three. Race three, one, two, three. So I'll give mine first to give my panel a chance to think. Paul Ricard, it's wide open. There's quite a few high-speed segments there. It's a test track, so I think it is going to be high grip as opposed to the street circuits we've been on. I think that will suit Mercedes, and I think it will be low tire wear. So for Paul Ricard, I am going for Hamilton, Verstappen, Perez. When we get to Austria, I think there will be slightly higher wear. I can't really remember. Maybe Matt will yell at me on his predictions. So I think on those races, I think Perez is going to be a little bit more competitive than we've seen. I think Bottas will be absent for all those three races. So for Austria 1, I'm going for Hamilton, Verstappen, Perez. And race 2, I'm going for Perez, Hamilton, Verstappen. All right, Christian, you've had enough time to think it over. What do you think? Predict stuff.
Paul Ricard, Hamilton, Leclerc, Sainz.
Leclerc in a Ferrari double podium?
Yeah,
have you been drinking? So. Have you been taking mushrooms? What is it the Vikings used to eat?
Let's wait and see. I think maybe they could do something good there.
He's gone berserker, everyone. I'm so sorry.
Austria 1, Max, Hamilton, Bottas. Austria 2, Hamilton, Max, Perez.
Oh, okay. I like it. So the number two swapping places. Come on.
I am going to predict fairly similar to you guys at Ricard in that I think Hamilton will win with Verstappen followed by Perez because I think Bottas just won't turn up. However, at Austria, for the first race, I think the championship is going to hot up and Lewis and Verstappen are going to collide at some point during the race. And that will allow Lando to come through and take his first ever victory.
Amazing. Trumpets.
Well, see, now I have a disagreement. Well, first of all, I'm really annoyed that you picked the exact podium as me for Paul Ricard. That's just like wrong. I feel like I have, there's clearly something broken in my brain at this point. But aside from that, I think at the Red Bull Ring, first race, we're going to see Verstappen, Hamilton, and Perez in that order. Second race is where I think it's all going to come to a head, Catman, and we're going to see Vettel, Perez, and then Norris on the podium.
Christian?
I just like these predictions because it makes you feel warm when Matt says Vettel as a winner. It just makes you feel good. Mm, it's probably not going to happen, but it makes me feel good.
It could happen.
It almost did happen. If Perez had had a good enough start, Hamilton would have taken him out and Vettel would have won at Baku.
Well, that concludes the news element of this episode of Missed Apex Podcast. If you want to follow any of our panel, Catman, Christian Pedersen or Matt Trumpets, look in the show notes and please do consider supporting us at patreon.com/missedapex. Don't go away. We're about to do this thing that's appearing now. Hi, guys. I'm here with our new friend, Jeff O'Boyle. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Spanners. How are you?
I'm good. For some reason, you've decided to talk to us about the olden days racing driver rivalries.
Yeah, well, you know, it's about inter-team battles more than anything else. And in recent years, we haven't really had any decent inter-team battles in modern Formula One. You've got Bottas version, you know, still no good. Insert number here against Hamilton. You had Max Verstappen against that carousel of mediocrity. And then you had Vettel and, you know, his demise. So we had to go back 30 years to find something decent to talk about.
Well, yeah, in recent times we've had obviously Rosberg, Hamilton. That seemed to be the kind of the definitive rivalry of our time. And then we've threatened to have an epic rivalry between Vettel and Hamilton, but it kind of fizzled out, didn't it? Like Ferrari, they had those two big challenges and they just kind of Ferrari'd out of it.
Yeah, they Ferrari'd themselves. I mean, the Rosberg-Hamilton one was pretty epic, but I still don't rank that as highly. I don't want to, you know, spoiler alert, I don't want to rank that as highly as some of the others because it was so short-lived and Hamilton's reliability record was so poor in 2016 that actually, you know, without the engine failures, he would have walked it.
Well, you're talking about olden days F1 rivalries, and it was all about just whose car didn't conk out a lot of the time.
Yeah, we'll come to that in the first rivalry, but you look back at some of those old races and the reliability was incredible. You've got, you know, I think Keke Rosberg won the championship in 82 just by finishing six races or something like that. It's ridiculous.
And didn't he only win one race that season as well?
He won one. I think he was one of two finishers.
Right, well, there we go. Okay, so we're going to take a peek back to the olden days. We're just going to start off with one rivalry that you've ranked lowest on your six rivalries you've pointed out. So who are we looking at from the past?
Yeah, so probably not a rivalry that's in the forefront of everyone's mind, but it's the mighty, notorious rivalry of René Arnoux against Alain Prost. A young, nasally endowed Prost had just arrived on the scene.
At Renault. So are we
at
sticking...
Renault.
Is your list all teammates?
So yes.
Inter-team battles?
Notionally called when teammates attack or when number twos go bad, depending on your point of view.
Yeah, well, you will have to assign who you think was the number two in this situation. So tell us a little bit, set some background for Arnoux versus Prost.
Yeah, so two very different drivers, both French, both Gallic, both a bit grumpy, both driving for the French super team at Renault. René Arnoux had a bit of a journeyman sort of career up to this point. He didn't have any money. He had to sort of scrape and, you know, tooth and nail into Formula One. He worked as a mechanic to try and fund himself, and he didn't really make it until he was well into his 30s. Prost, on the other hand, was France's young hope. He was well-funded by Elf. As he said himself in his autobiography, in his entire racing career, it never cost him a son team. In terms of the racing background, Arnoux was well-established, very well-regarded. He potential future world champion, as every driver who arrives in F1 is billed at some point or other. And he was the team leader in 1980. I know we're going back a fair bit here to the olden days.
No. The thing is, the 80s for me, I was born in 1980. You were born several decades before that. So for me, I did watch races in the 80s being plonked down in front of the sofa. You love Formula One now. You can't tell me what to do. Ooh, race cars. I've probably watched these races and these championships we're talking about, but they did never sunk in. So when you say to me, as a 40-year-old, René Arnoux, nothing sparks. I had to research him. But it says, yeah, he's entered in 1978. He's racing for Martini Surtees, and then his career ends in 1989. So a substantial Grand Prix career.
Yeah, he was around for a long time, but then you didn't have the feeder series that we do now, where there's, you know, a constant sort of ladder of talent knocking on the door to try and get in. It was quite different back then. If you got in, you could usually hang around one way or another for a team. But Prost was quite different. He'd only had one season in Formula One in 1980, and it was pretty unspectacular. He was with McLaren, finished 15th in the championship, and the car was terrible. It just retired. Well, I think it retired more often than it didn't. It was still probably finished halfway up in the championship because reliability was so poor. This was the turbo era engine, so they would just constantly be on fire. You know, you'd be leading by 15 seconds, then, oh no, you're on fire. Then this would continue until the guy in 10th would eventually limp across the line.
People hark back to like classic Grand Prix, and I just remember sitting there with my dad, and the start would be really exciting. Murray Walker, bless him, would do his best to make it seem exciting, but you were just waiting for an engine to blow up, and then you go, oh, there it is! Berger's engine's blown up. Something interesting's happened. But you would just sit there waiting. It was like Monaco every race.
It was. And I mean, you look back at it through modern safety standards as well. It's terrifying. You have to watch it from behind the cushion because they just park up. There's no yellow flag. There's no runoff. There's a car sort of still on the racing line. Half of it's on the racing line. Half of it's on the grass. It's all on fire. And there are marshals running across the track.
It's all on fire.
We're just still at full speed. Everyone's at full speed. Another one's on fire going past that one. It's terrifying to watch it. One of the races that we're looking at recently, and the car ended up in the catch fencing where 12 spectators were slightly injured. And you think, why were people standing up against the catch fencing 6 feet from the track?
Yep.
But it was a different time. Elson safety gone mad nowadays, isn't it? It's just gone mad.
It's political correctness gone safety. That's what it is. So this is René Arnoux's team, and yep. Prost enters it.
Prost enters it because he's French, effectively, but he hasn't done anything in 1980 to show that he was going to be Le Prof.
So what were the expectations from most people at the time? You were quite old already at the time. So
yeah, I was just coming up to my second career at B&Q at the time. He was definitely expected to be the number two, a proper number two. Right. This guy doesn't know anything. He's going to learn a lot from Lemaitre, from René Arnoux. He'll fall into line and we might get a 1-2 finish if we finish a race, you know, that sort of
status. This is a bit Hamilton-y with Alonso.
Yeah, very, very Hamilton Alonso. Spoiler alert again, but very, very Hamilton Alonso.
Okay.
So, yeah, the sort of scene was set in 1981 for a fairly routine. René Arnoux will be number one, Prost will be number two, and we'll see where we finish. But Prost didn't quite get the message, and he was instantly much faster than René Arnoux. He didn't always out-qualify him, but he did more often than not beat him in the race. So in the first season together, you know, Prost finished, I think he only finished five races, but he finished every one of them on the podium and scored 43 points. Arnoux, on the other hand, finished two more races, I think it was, and he scored 11 points. So a little bit of Gallic tension between the two teammates, which really blew up in 1982. So this was the Malaysia Vettel Weber of its era. I have to try and bring some modern context to this because there isn't much spice in this story. I have to try and justify why it's in here. in the French Grand Prix in 1982, Arnoux was leading, Prost was in second, but Prost still had a good chance of winning the championship. Arnoux was nowhere. So he got the team orders, and back then you might imagine there was no team radio, so they had to use old-fashioned pit boards.
No way. Hang out a pit board. Oh, mate, so it's not even like all subtle on the radio. It's like fully displaying. Here's a sign that shows you how terribly you're doing.
Yeah, and it was a sort of... they gave a secret coded message to Arnoux. His pit crew chief, LaRousse, held out the pit board, and it gave the subtle message... Prost 1, Arnoux 2, which was incredible given that they were running in the reverse order during the race.
Yep.
So, yeah, it wasn't ideal that Arnoux chose to ignore that pit message and win in front of the French fans.
So he got the multi-21 and just decided...
He got the multi-21 and ignored it. He was the Seb Vettel of 1982, the Bete Noir. That effectively ended whatever shred of relationship the two teammates had together. I mean, they hated each other already, but that was it. All trust was gone. The line down the garage had been drawn. And at the end of the season, Prost was retained and went on to great things. And Arnoux was forced to go to Ferrari, which might sound like a great move, but it's Ferrari.
The way you say it definitely made it sound like a punishment. He was banished to Ferrari. René, you're going to Ferrari. No, sacre bleu, I can change. I will let him buy next time.
It was too late for all that. He'd have to go to Ferrari and spend most of the time sitting at the side of the road watching his Ferrari on fire.
So Prost definitely won that exchange.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, that set him up. That raised his stock level quite high in Formula One, whereas, you know, up until that point, he hadn't been that highly regarded. But to come in and dominate a number two, it's exactly what Hamilton did against Alonso, but to a higher degree. I mean, the gap in performance was really high between the two. You know, 2007, Hamilton-Alonso was a much closer fight and a bit spicier as well. But, I mean, there's not a huge amount of spice in the press when you look back at the stories around this, but
heard of this. You're literally the only person who's ever spoken about this as a topic.
In that case, let me make up an anecdote, which in the attempt to make it sound spicy. In Prost's autobiography, he writes about an incident where after the race in France in 82, when he'd been denied the win that he thought he deserved, a French petrol station attendant recognized him as the Formula One Renault driver, but thought he was Monsieur Arnoux. So he said to him in French, "Well done, Monsieur Arnoux. You did exactly the right thing, showing that little expletive Prost, who's boss." Presumably he paid by cash rather than card and got back in the car again. That's the level of discontentment at the lower rankings of our inter-team rivalry battles.
Well, the good news, if this is an ongoing series, is that this is the lowest on the list, so presumably they'll get less bad as we go forward.
yeah, I mean, this is poor. Let's not dress this up in any other way. Yeah. This is not the best inter-team battle you're going to get, but hopefully there's enough to draw people in to think, this can't get any worse. We're really scraping the barrel here. They do get much, much better, I promise.
I can go full Toto Wolf here. It was not acceptable. We have had a bad day. We've had a bad recording. The selection was of content was poor, and it was poorly delivered. There's no excuses. We can just do that, can't we?
Spanners, you win as a team and you lose as a team, so we have to take shared responsibility
for this. Not in this scenario. It is all the panelists' fault. But if you want to follow Jeff, presumably you've got some social media, even though you spell Jeff incorrectly, spell it with a J.
Yeah, it's something like at Jeff O'Boyle on Twitter. I think my 13 followers will be delighted to have another one.
There's going
to
be like 1,000 Jeff O'Boyles. Good luck with that. So what we'll do is we'll put a link to your social media in the show notes below. Jeff O'Boyle, thanks for dropping into the shed. Come back soon.
Thanks. Bye, Spanners.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Now we're joined by the hardest working man in tech F1, Matthew Summerfield, a.k.a. Summers F1, assistant technical editor at motorsport.com, who is deigned to sit down and share some wisdom with us. It's good to see you again. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on again, Matt, because obviously we had a fantastic race weekend and we got plenty of technical stuff to talk about because of that.
I actually kind of want to ask you some questions about Hamilton's brake magic, or as I now call it, brake tragic incident at the restart of the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. Now, at the time, they said it was a lever. He hit it accidentally. It messed with the brakes, caused him to lock up. You have done some delving into this, I suspect. Can you give us a little more accurate picture of what was going on there?
Okay, so I think to build a picture to start with, perhaps we might be best off to work out what brake magic is and how long it's been around and what it, you know, what we're actually talking about when we talk about brake magic. Okay, so brake magic has been around since the start of the hybrid era. That is because of the brake-by-wire systems that are on the car. And that means that the engineers can create different maps that obviously control the level of brake bias that is not only going front to rear, but also the bias between what's going on with the hybrid system. So you can obviously do some clever things in how you control all of that. With brake magic engaged, effectively what you do is shift a huge amount of the braking performance forward in the car. And in terms of what Mercedes use brake magic for, is to keep or try to increase the amount of tyre temperature on the front tyres. So effectively what they've done, or Lewis Hamilton has done in this case on the way to the restart, is he's used brake magic in order that he can get the front tyres piping hot, ready to go into turn one. And that's why we saw the brake smoking. That wasn't something that was, you know, not designed to be in that situation. Lewis wanted that situation. He wanted the brakes almost on fire, the as much energy going into those front tyres as possible, so that when he got to turn one, he had got a huge amount of grip. Because as we know, the tyres this year are very difficult to get in that window for the front end of the car. And obviously everybody changed tyres during the red flag period. So we're on fresh tyres rather than the ones that have been cycled through throughout the race. Now, in a piece that I did post Grand Prix, I did mention the fact that in my eyes, it would be about 90% forward on the brake bias. But obviously, since then, there's been people looking at the footage, and I was pretty accurate. 86.5% is what the brake bias was on the front end. And usually the drivers have their brake bias somewhere between sort of 50 to 60%, depending on the corner and the circuit characteristics. If you go back and watch some of Rosberg's laps, for argument's sake, when he was driving the Mercedes, you'll see that on some of his qualifying laps, he was changing the brake bias on pretty much every single corner to try and get that absolute maximum performance out of the car. And that's essentially what Lewis was trying to do, is get performance from the car so that when he arrived in turn one, he could take the lead away from Perez. Unfortunately, what has happened is on the restart, he has disengaged brake magic. He's then launched the car, and unfortunately, he's then clipped the button that engages brake magic again as he's trying to overtake Perez. And that happened because of the way that they were jinking around on the straight, apparently. If you actually listen to the radio call between him and Bono at the end of the race, he describes it, Bono, this is, as Lewis having clipped the button on the upshift. So that indicates that obviously the button is in the realms of where Hamilton's hands would be on the steering wheel for the upshift. Now, Mercedes haven't exactly been opaque in terms of where the brake magic button is in the past, because, you know, it's not something that they want to effectively give away to their rivals, although all of the teams have some version of brake magic on their cars. However, I think what we will see, obviously we're pre-recording this segment, but what I think we will see is that Mercedes will be a little bit more opaque when they do their debrief midweek and just let people understand what actually and where actually that is on the steering wheel. I think, though, that where Lewis has had the problem perhaps is his engagement of the clutch system during his start, because I'm sure you've seen this, Matt, from his onboards. He has a very different way of holding the steering wheel when he does his launches, and has his left hand in the top corner of the steering wheel whilst he balances the clutch with his right hand, because he has a different setup on the back of the steering wheel to Bottas in that respect as well.
Right. I have actually seen that, because you were correct. I did go back and watch a few times, although I was watching because they said it was a lever, and I was looking at his wheel and I didn't see any, but I did see a picture tweeted out with a rotary that says brake magic. I assume that's for setting exactly what and how much you want, and then the button engages it for the driver. But my question about that over the top thing is, it does look like it, but usually upshifts are on the opposite side. They're usually right-handed. So is this perhaps an ambidextrous brake magic button? And having gotten that one question in, I will now shoehorn my famous second question in. If I'm Mercedes and I want to fix this, am I redesigning the button that I use to do this and where it's placed? Or am I looking at potentially a software solution whereby, if the car is in launch mode, brake magic simply cannot be engaged?
Okay, so first of all, brake balance on the steering wheel has multi-functions. There's not a single button that controls the brake balance or the brake bias. So you have two buttons for up and down. You have the brake balance rotary, and you also have a rotary called BMIG, which is brake migration. And that's to do with the way in which that the hybrid system works with the brake balance. So it's an adjustability setting for the drivers. On top of that, you've then got this fifth control, which is the brake magic. Now, in my opinion, having studied the footage. I'm sure, as I said, we will have more information come midweek about Break Magic. Perhaps Mercedes will finally reveal all in their debrief. But for me, it perhaps is what Lewis is doing with his top, with his left hand on the top end of the left-hand side of the steering wheel as we look at the steering wheel, is that he's actually holding that button in. If you look on the back of the Mercedes wheel, you will see at the top, there are two buttons in the top corners. And then you've also got the obviously the clutch paddles and the up and down shift paddles. I believe that in that top left-hand corner, he's holding that brake magic button as a way of holding the car against the clutch, perhaps using it as a way of effectively using a handbrake. And then you obviously come off of that to disengage the brake magic, effectively disengage the handbrake and release the clutch. So it could be a sort of tactic that Mercedes and Hamilton himself have come up with to enable him to get a better launch so that he can hold the clutch against the car. But as I say, I think we'll get more information on this throughout the course of the next few days.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you taking the time. And for anyone who needs a visual stimulation to go along with that exquisite audio description, I believe there was a very nice picture published in one of the articles that Motorsport did about that. And I'm not sure if you've retweeted it yourself or not, but it should be pretty easy to find.
I have, and there are a couple of images in there. I worked pretty hard to find all the steering wheel images in the wake of, obviously, Mercedes' issue. And there's more actually available if you go to the F1 gallery to look at the steering wheel itself.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. I know a lot of people were very excited to see the titanic battle between Hamilton and Verstappen for the championship. But I actually kind of found myself a bit disappointed because the titanic struggle I was really looking forward to was that between Red Bull and Mercedes about the bendy wings. We had Wolff threatening protests aplenty. We had Horner tossing it back in his face. And at the end of the day, it was a nothing burger. No one complained about anything. Nothing really happened. And so I say boo, but I assume you can tell us a little bit more about why exactly nothing happened and what did go on instead.
Yeah, so basically, there's a couple of things that played out during the Azerbaijan Grand Prix weekend. The first one being that the FIA asked for all of the teams to install some dots on their rear wing. There's 12 dots on each of the rear wings now, and they're using that as a reference point to be able to understand from the rear-facing camera what all of the teams are doing in terms of the flexibility of the rear wing. So that's going to give them a baseline going into the French Grand Prix, where obviously the new rules come into play. So I think a lot of the teams perhaps thought, there's no point us protesting here because the FIA are actually being pretty proactive in what they're doing. I mean, obviously, if the result had swung one way or another in one or another's favour in terms of the drivers' championship, then perhaps we might be thinking otherwise. But I don't believe that there was actually ever going to be a protest after a certain point, because it just became obvious that the FIA have been pretty proactive in terms of trying to deal with this situation.
Okay, but that said, we didn't see the bendy wing on the Red Bull. So is that Mercedes winning, or is that Red Bull winning? I mean, it's they seem to have the winning car. So did they just have Mercedes chasing their tail for a couple of weeks for their own amusement, or is Mercedes the secret victor here?
Well, I think that's a bit of a misnomer because we did see what I would classify as a bendy wing on both cars. You have to remember that the straight in Baku is exceptionally long, one of the longest straights that we see on the calendar. So effectively, Red Bull bought a new rear wing specification for Baku, which stripped some of the downforce off the rear wing itself because it didn't have a gurney strip on the trailing edge. And they also trimmed some of the rear edge off the top flap as well. They also installed new end plates, which means that the vortices that are created at the wingtip are less aggressive with that particular wing spec. So in other words, they were doing things differently. It's a bit of an apples and oranges scenario because we haven't got the same wings as we had before. And that's the same if you look on the other side of the fence, which I'm sure we'll get to a little bit later on as well, is that Mercedes had very different specification wings on their two cars. So, you know, you're kind of comparing different things to what we've had in the past, alongside the fact that we've, you know, got new tests incoming, and they're trying to get to a point whereby they will be compliant with those tests for the French Grand Prix.
Okay, so what you're essentially saying is that the wings themselves were fundamentally different because all the teams know the tests are coming, and then they're in the process of development to pass the new test. So I guess you could sort of call that a Mercedes win, except for at the end of the day, the Red Bull seemed like it was the faster car during the race. Now, you said these will be ready for Paul Ricard. I have one more question that I do want to ask about this. Horner explicitly mentioned front wings. I assume we didn't see any front wing dots, but we know from footage we've seen in the past that the front wings are, well, pretty flexy too. Do you expect perhaps an updated test for the front wings as well going into the 22 season?
I think there's a very different discussion topic there, because the 22 regs have a different set of parameters anyway, because obviously we've got different designs to the wings themselves. And on top of that, the tests, the load tests, etc., are different for the 22 cars. So as I've mentioned in the past, I think we've got a situation here where perhaps the FIA have been trying to pad the situation out, knowing that they were kind of on the back foot, but didn't want to make wholesale changes because of the cost cap and the implications that has to everybody in terms of the development going towards the end of this season, and obviously the impact that then that has on next season. And so I think we're in a situation where the front wing test probably won't be adjusted for 21 because of those criteria for the cost cap, and we've got new tests and obviously a new car in its totality coming for 22 anyway.
Okay, so let's move on a bit. We know that, and to my surprise, that the power unit you got is the power unit you got this season. And yet I see on Twitter that Honda, who seem like they already brought a pretty big upgrade to the whole season, is bringing an upgrade to Paul Ricard. How is this possible? I thought it was against the rule.
Yeah, but Matt, don't you remember what used to happen in the V8 era when the V8s were frozen and suddenly every single Grand Prix somebody had a reliability upgrade? So if you can shoehorn a performance upgrade alongside your reliability upgrade, then you can kind of get around the fact that you're bringing a performance upgrade, because the essential part of that upgrade is for reliability purposes, which we understand that Honda have actually had the power unit cranked down a little bit in the opening phase of the season to be able to allow them to get the mileage that they needed to get to this reliability upgrade that's incoming for the French Grand Prix.
Okay, so hang on a second. What you're telling me is Honda has been fighting with one hand behind its back, and there is even more power to come from that unit? And if that's the case, I mean, where are they relative to Mercedes? Are they pushing them, or do you think maybe they've surpassed them at this point?
I wouldn't suggest that Honda have surpassed Mercedes, and I don't think they will do even with the supposed upgrade that's coming for the French Grand Prix. I think they've got much, much closer than anybody has actually achieved during the hybrid era, except for the 2019 Ferrari engine, which we have to say no more about. The Honda power unit is far and beyond the ability that I think most people thought that the Japanese manufacturer would be able to get to when they arrived back in the sport. And I think we remember them having, you know, a new power unit at every single race. And suddenly they've got to a point, and we've talked about this in the past, Matt, where we thought that they would get to this point. It was just how long it would take. But unfortunately for them, they're withdrawing from the sport at the end of the season, and they're not going to see the full spoils of what they've been able to achieve. On top of that, you have to remember that the amount of changes that they made this season to their power unit going into this season, I think they're inevitably going to come across reliability issues, because fundamentally they've changed a huge swathe of parts on the car, the power unit even, to be able to maximise performance from the changes in the regulations that occurred last season. And a specification that they were kind of trying to hold over for 2022 has kind of been brought forward one stage to get them to where they are for this season.
Right. Okay. So that makes sense. Fundamentally, there were some reliability issues. They have fixed the reliability issues, and just very conveniently, that will allow them to run the engine higher, hotter, and longer than they previously were able to. That's sort of fascinating. But you know what's really fascinating?
What's that?
Tires.
Yeah, well, they're the black art of motorsport.
They are, and they were center stage at the last race, but not in the good, happy Pirelli PR marketing guys kind of way, but in the unfortunate, we're going to have to explain this to the world sort of way. So you saw, I assume, the race. You saw the failures. I'm going to ask sort of, what have you heard about them? Do you know when Pirelli's going to be able to drop sort of an official explanation to us? And last of all, Verstappen was very skeptical right off the bat. The moment Pirelli said, well, you know, we're going to go with, we think it was probably debris based on what we've seen so far. And he immediately seemed to sort of imply that, oh, they always just say that no matter what the real cause is. Is there any validity to that? In your opinion, I mean, is he just suffered more than his fair share of tire-related race-ending issues, so he's just got a complex, so to speak, or do you think Pirelli might, well, you know, given a choice of explaining a 50-50 thing, way A or way B, they're going to go with the way that makes them look less bad, which is sort of also understandable.
I think there's a multitude of scenarios unfolding before our very eyes, as usual. I think one of the big things is that we have to remember how much the cars have changed since the start of 2020 because of the regulation changes that came in for 2021. We also then got a new set of tyres for this season. And the downforce levels, I think, are beyond where anybody expected the teams to get, based on how much downforce was technically taken away from them. And so, you know, we're in a situation where the tyres are being pushed to their limits once more. We saw what happened at Silverstone last year in that very scenario where the tyres were beyond their capacity. I do think it is an unfortunate situation that we find ourselves in again from a PR point of view for Pirelli, because they're always the bad guy in everybody's playbook. Pirelli have always done wrong. However, I always air back to 2013 and Silverstone, when the teams were lumping on Pirelli as if everything was their fault. However, it was not their fault. The teams were tyre swapping, i.e. they were putting tyres that were designated for one side of the car on the opposite side of the car. And ever since that point, you know, you have to think about, how are the teams operating beyond the scope of what Pirelli intend for the tyres? And, you know, they're always trying to find performance, no matter how far they have to stretch their luck. We only have to look at flexi wings in that scenario. However, I do think that this will come back as a debris issue. Lewis's tyre was found to have, I think it was a 6 or 7 centimetre slit in the tyre, and he was lucky not to be in the same situation that we already had two tyres fail at as well. I don't know how many other tyres were in that situation, and I think Pirelli will probably take a little time to try to investigate and find out exactly the root cause of this problem. In the past, they've blamed curbs. We've had debris problems as well in the past. You know, at the end of the day, they are the design and a product that has to work at some pretty intense speeds and loads. And unfortunately, we are ending up in a situation where we've got tyres going and failing. But, you know, there's sort of a lot of things that can go on to cause that situation. And that's unfortunately, where Pirelli find themselves in the middle of a bit of an argument with drivers who think that, you know, X or Y is happening, and perhaps it's not. For me, I think that we'll be back in a situation where it's a debris problem again.
Okay, well, I have to say that was sort of my initial inclination, mostly for the following reason, that pretty much everybody was on the same tire stint with the same tire. And we saw Stroll in the first stint fail, and then we saw Max in the second stint. But the 8 or 9 other drivers that were on the same lap or even later laps did not have a failure issue. Whereas in the past, like you mentioned in 13, you saw 5 or 6 cars go out. And that was clearly a tire failure issue. Although, as you rightly note, teams were running tires backwards on the wrong side, fully against what Pirelli had told them to do. So I don't think we can blame Pirelli in the same way it would be if tires just like started doing, 2005 Indianapolis? I forget which one it was.
It was, yes. I also think that it's important to remember that this is the most unloaded tire as well. It's not the one that takes all the stress. And so for me, that suggests that there's an outside force involved rather than something that's directly impacted the tire to cause the failure.
Okay, so let's go on and let's have a brief discussion about Valtteri Bottas. Now, I apologize to people who listen to our Sunday show already because I already berated everyone about this, but I'm increasingly baffled, and I think Bottas is too, by his inability to make these tires work, to the point where he said, either there's a problem with my car or it was the tires. And yet, when I listen to Mercedes and his race engineer in the race, they seem to have no answers for him whatsoever about this. So has Mercedes gone and done that thing that we always accuse Red Bull of doing, essentially designing a car that only one driver can drive? Are we there? Because, I mean, you can't say Bottas is a terrible driver. He may not be doing the job Mercedes wants him to do right now, but is that entirely down to him, or is it something down to their engineering and design for this season's regulations?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does hark back to the change in regulations and how that has an impact on the way in which the car must be driven. I think it's very important to remember that we've got a different tyre construction and a different tyre at the front, which has changed the way in which you have to drive the car to get the heat into the front tyres. The exact reason why Hamilton did what he did at the restart to get that temperature fired into the front tyre to get it to work straight away. So, yes, obviously Valtteri is having a problem with the W12 this year in trying to get the performance from it. I think that was evident right from the start. If you look back in Bahrain when they were having trouble with the car in general, I think the car has a very narrow operating window. So every time they go to a circuit, they are struggling to find the sweet spot. You see that throughout free practice because they're trying more and more things every single race weekend to try to unlock that performance. And that is not a trait that we have seen from Mercedes in the past. They've usually arrived, they've found the sweet spot, and then they just crank on the performance. And they don't seem able to do that this year. They're just struggling to get to that very narrow window that the tyre operates within. So much to the point that they split their drivers this weekend. Happened in Portimao, but again this weekend, Valtteri Bottas was on the high downforce rear wing. Lewis Hamilton was on the lower downforce rear wing. And it appears that Hamilton found what he needed to in FP3 to suggest that they were going to get the performance they needed from the lower downforce rear wing. At that point, they're kind of locked in and can't change Bottas, who's decided earlier on that he's sticking with the high downforce rear wing. And he just cannot get the front to rear balance on the tyres. That's the fundamental problem. It's a bit of a vicious circle because you get the temperature in the front tyres, but you lose it from the rear tyres and so on and so forth. It's what I tend to call a Goldilocks problem. You know, it's a bit too hot, it's a bit too cold, but can I really find the one in the middle?
Okay, so having said that, I mean, how much are we blaming Valtteri for this? How much are we blaming Mercedes for this? Just ballpark it for me, because he's coming under increasing amounts of criticism. And part of me is like, well, entirely justified criticism. But on the other hand, I realize that the person he's being compared to is, you know, arguably the best, most complete driver on the grid at this point in time. So that's quite a comparison to be making. Would anybody else in that seat be having the same problems? I guess that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, well, we only have to look across the grid to Red Bull to find that exact answer. They have searched for this issue for a number of years because they have had a car that is very much in the same line as what we're seeing from the W12 this year, in as much as that one driver seems to be able to find that narrow sweet spot where they can get the performance from it, and the other driver just struggles around for most of the weekend and occasionally manages to find the performance they need. Luckily for Valtteri, his qualifying pace is always pretty good. So he always finds himself in a relatively good position from a qualifying standpoint. If we look at Portimao, for example, he found that sweet spot in qualifying. But the problem was that that sweet spot for qualifying meant that he overdrove the tyres during the race and started to slide back into the clutches of the other two drivers. And so, like I say, I think it is more to do with having a very narrow operating window for this car, which has been driven by the factors of the 2021 regulation changes and also obviously the changes to the tyres. Valtteri isn't a bad driver. There's no two ways about it. You don't win races. You don't put the car on pole for absolutely no reason. He is a top line driver. It's just that he's not perhaps at the absolute level that Lewis Hamilton is. We have to remember he's a 7-time world champion and has straddled many, many regulation changes. Now, that's the big difference between the quality of a driver of Hamilton who's done it across a decade or more versus a driver that has, you know, he's very good on his day, but hasn't perhaps got the car underneath him for the race day as well.
Okay. So as we start to run short of minutes, I'm going to segue off of that and say, speaking of drivers like that, it came to my attention that Sebastian Vettel had a pretty good weekend. And he'd had a pretty good weekend at the last race. And all of a sudden, Aston, who looked like, oh, you know, sort of in that Alpine, sort of second middle of the midfield battle, suddenly they look very, very good. Was it just track specific? This is a particular track that suits them. Have they figured out how their car works to the point where they can actually set it up for their drivers? Or did they just finally make the parts that work with a concept that they've chosen? And so if you have any insight on that, I'd be very curious to hear your thoughts.
So again, I think it's a bit of all of those bits and pieces put together. Very much that obviously all of the Mercedes and Ferrari powered teams took new power units for Baku, so which means that they obviously have more tools at their disposal in terms of straight line speed, just general performance around the lap, because the parts aren't aging out. So obviously, you know, it's the same as anything, isn't it? When you get something brand new, it always feels that much better once it's first fitted to the car or whatever discipline you're currently in. On top of that, I think that Aston Martin have kind of settled down into a pattern. They started the season a little bit erratic in terms of bringing parts to the car and trying to close that deficit on the changes for 2021. They've ploughed a huge amount of resource into the car in the opening phase of the season to try to close that gap. And I think that was always their intention, but it does lead to distraction because you have so much to understand to unlock that performance. And if something doesn't quite work and you don't understand why it works, then you're kind of backpedaling to try to find out why and what can you do to resolve that problem. So to me, they seem to have found a more of a sweet spot in terms of the performance of the aerodynamic map and also obviously the way in which that works with the car in general. On top of that, you have to remember that Sebastian Vettel moved from a Ferrari-powered car to a Mercedes-powered car, and there's a lot of different nuance between the way in which that those power units operate. And so that means that obviously he had a lot to learn when he moved into the Aston Martin seat as well.
Excellent. Well, thanks for that. And before we officially check out, I always like talking to you because you always see things that don't get reported. You always have a thing or a development that everybody else has missed, but you've seen. So I'm just going to ask, like, what has grabbed your attention over the course of this last race week? And, or where should we be looking that we're not right now?
Oh, well, it's a lot of small things, isn't it, essentially? I think the interesting things, obviously, that you saw in Baku were the wing levels, the differences between high and low downforce setups. There was a tiny, tiny difference between Perez and Verstappen's rear wing that we noticed, which basically is a small few millimetres trimmed off the top flap just to take away a little downforce and a little more drag. Obviously, Max a little bit more comfortable with a slightly looser rear end in the slower sections of the track, but that enabled him to obviously try and push on down the straights. And then Aston Martin, again, we've just discussed obviously them bringing updates in the past, but they did have a small update for Baku, which was only on Stroll's car. Unfortunately, he was the one that didn't get the result, but he had the updates. And he had a new fairing on the halo. They've taken away the boomerang winglet and replaced it with a couple of upstand fins. And also they've changed the wing mirror mountings, which have now the serrated edge, a bit like Mercedes, which you would expect given obviously the way in which that those two cars follow each other in terms of development. But there's always lots and lots of tiny details to pay attention to. And as you know, I try to put that out there as much as I can through social media and obviously on my articles with Motorsport.
Well, you are jumping the gun here because I was just about to ask, where can all of our listeners find you?
Well, as usual, as I just mentioned, the best place to find me is on Twitter, SummersF1, or obviously my work over on motorsport.com as well.
And don't forget, SummersF1.co.uk, which I can almost barely remember at my advanced age.
Yes, unfortunately, I haven't really updated the blog of late because I've got so much other work going on, but it is something that I'm trying to think about for the end of the season with perhaps a big review of all of the updates that we've seen throughout the season.
Well, I can't wait to see that. And in the meantime, thanks for stopping by, and I hope you'll come back soon.
Of course I will, and thanks for having me.
As always, we'll talk soon.
So there is a new initiative in the world of Formula One. As you're probably aware, Sebastian Vettel is a strong advocate for LGBTQ rights and visibility. To help me speak on that subject is Chris Stevens. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Spanners.
Hey, so this Racing Pride initiative from Aston Martin, what do you know about it?
Well, Racing Pride was set up a few years ago to kind of just push the LGBT visibility within motorsport. There aren't all too many examples of LGBT people within motorsport, be that drivers or people who work for the team or marshals, stewards, you know, the full works. And what they do is to help bring those people to the center stage.
So I think it's a case of being able to say, hello, I am part of that community and I want to be able to talk about it without coming under, you know, coming under threat from abusive people or homophobic people. And if I do, because we've done it as part of this incentive, I guess, this initiative incentive, I can come to you and talk to you about it instead of having to hide or feel afraid.
Exactly. It's a community thing. And, you know, community is a real buzzword around LGBT because, you know, there's strength in numbers.
And you are an openly bisexual ex-journalist and you are currently a PR person within motorsport. I think that is the right. It's right that you're openly out and openly bisexual, but I can't imagine that everyone would be comfortable being open about it in that kind of environment that you've worked in.
No, absolutely not. I'm with good reason. the idea of coming out is very, very scary to even just anyone, let alone in the macho world of motorsport. And, you know, the statistics kind of back it up. You know, we live in a world where people are still killed for their sexuality, even here in the civilized world. A fifth of LGBT people in this country are the victim of a hate crime every year. That's almost 15,000 people. And so the one statistic that really caught my eye is that one in 10 people who attend a sporting event in 2019 experienced discrimination in the UK. And sport is, you know, it's big man, macho time, and the stereotypical gay man is a camp man, a physically weak man. And the two never seem to kind of gel together. And the reality, of course, is that's total rubbish.
There is definitely still that stereotype that a homosexual man will somehow have less of the traditionally male traits that you need to be a good athlete, to be a brave driver. But statistically, there must be gay drivers, gay mechanics, bisexual pit gun people. And they, I guess, are still feeling a pressure to hide who they really are. And you could say, well, no big deal that you don't talk about your sexuality at work and therefore you get left alone. But the point of that sort of upsets me is that, you know, they're not bringing their partners maybe to the work event. They can't just join in normal conversations. They're being denied just basic everyday slices of life that we take for granted.
Exactly. You know, people will be talking about their relationships. You don't want to talk about your relationship because you think it's going to make people uncomfortable, or you think people are going to treat you differently because of it. Is it any wonder that Gareth Thomas didn't come out as gay for so long while he was playing rugby? The prime motorsport example is Danny Watts, a two-time class winner at Le Mans, who didn't come out until after he had retired. And he said, because you feel like you have to hide it within motorsport because it's a very masculine sport. That was his quote.
And wasn't there some concern over sponsorships as well, that it would affect his backing and his funding to race?
Perhaps it can do. I've never heard that specifically.
Sure. But if we are kind of open and somebody does come out and then there's a correlation where you then see the sponsorship and funding has gone down, at least they can point to a graph and say, well, this is where I came out and this is where my funding dried up, and we can kind of be a bit more open about it.
Exactly. I mean, I think people think that motorsport doesn't have an issue with sexuality. And the truth is, how can we possibly know that when people are too afraid to be themselves?
Yeah. No, I'd look, what am I called? What is my, in that thing, I'm
heterosexual,
cis,
straight, whatever you want.
There was like a cisgendered male, I think, is that what I am?
Oh, yes, yeah, a straight cisgender male.
Right, there we go. So having that kind of privilege of never having to worry about bringing my wife to an event or talk about my relationships, it can be very hard for me to care. And I'll admit, whilst I hope I've never been homophobic, I don't think I've been an ally. I don't think I've been an ally. That face you made implied that I have sometimes been.
No, I was being serious. No, you haven't. You're fine.
You're not really. But I tell you what, I may have, through like a lack of understanding, been dismissive of the challenges of the LGBT community in the past. Certainly, the example that will haunt me for the rest of my life is my cousin not bringing his boyfriend to our wedding. You know, they were in a long-term committed relationship, and because of the homophobic element in my family, I didn't invite, not that I didn't invite him, but he didn't feel comfortable to come. Whereas I should have told everyone else to bog off and made sure they came to the wedding. So what does being an ally involve? If we want to be a motorsport fan and make our sport inclusive to people in the LGBTQ community, like we're trying to do with people of color, and like we tried to do with women so that there were no grid girls making them feel uncomfortable, what can we do to be good allies to that community?
I think a simple "we support you" message can go a really long way. And it's essentially what Aston Martin has done here. And, you know, if they do things, you know, like they're saying they're going to put like a pride flag on the car for France, for example, stuff like that. I mean, Sebastian Vettel had a rainbow helmet for a couple of races. I can't remember when.
Last season,
Yeah, but seeing a Formula One team do that in particular is just an incredible feeling, because I think a lot of straight people, they don't understand it, because no one's ever batted an eyelid at who they love, and they've never had to explain themselves to their family and their friends for their, you know, the way they live their life. So a simple "we support you" goes a really, really long way.
Yeah, so you can't hide being black, you can't hide being a woman, but you can hide your sexuality, which means that for straight people like me, we have had the problem solved for us, because the hostile environment has made people hide. And so we've not actually had to face up to how we would react in those situations. And this is wonderful from Aston Martin to just get the conversation going. Sebastian Vettel has been an open ally of the community as well. What happens when we go to Saudi Arabia, a country in which homosexuality is a crime? What happens? How do we support the team members? Because there will be gay team members going to a country where it's illegal to be gay. Do those flags still stay on the cars? Or does everybody shut up and cower?
Well, this is not the first race that's going to be held in a country where being gay is illegal. And it's the number one question I saw when Aston Martin made this announcement. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, what, you're suddenly going to shut up when you go to Saudi and this is all going to be over? The short answer is we really don't know. I mean, they say that they should boycott the race, which is a ridiculous thing for me, because what you are then doing is taking the people who are sending out this message and then not taking it to a place where it needs to be heard more than here, really, when you think about it in the grand scheme of things. So I don't know what's going to happen when they race there, if they're going to be allowed to run a pride flag on that car or whatever. If they're not, it's not Aston Martin's fault.
So I think I'm slightly misaligned to you. Here would be my thinking. Not that I have any power or say. I think you're right. If we can go there and race and show those pride flags, not just to make a point, but do the normal things that they would want to do. Sebastian Vettel is free to wear his pride flag. Then you can go and race. You can make that message. If people who are openly gay or bisexual or trans in the teams have to go through special measures to hide it, if they're told, don't be, you dress up as a boy to feel so everyone feels more comfortable, or whatever you do, don't talk about being gay, or it's best if you stay in the hotel when everybody else is out. If that kind of thing happens, then I would say, Chris, I would go a bit further and say, if that's the case, you should think about not hosting your race there, because otherwise we race as one is absolutely useless. If one person is in the hotel room afraid, then you're not racing as one.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to hear some examples of, you know, places, other countries where they've had similar issues and what measures they've had to go for. It could be that no one's bat an eyelid at it, because I think when you're at a racetrack, it's very, you know, enclosed and it's very isolated from the rest of the actual country. And they, you know, they certain rules apply at the racetrack that don't apply to the rest of the country a lot of the time, not just in Formula One, and a lot of other like global championships and sporting events as well. So yeah, I would love to hear some stories from people who actually, you know, go and do this.
I would be really interested on people's take on the conversation we've had. Obviously, Chris is much more informed about the topic, and you can see like the discomfort on my face because I'm trying to make sure I say the right phrases and be as inclusive and PC as possible, because I just don't have that kind of wealth of experience and background in making sure I say the right thing. So if you think I've said anything wrong, I'm happy to listen to it. spanners@missedapex.net. And I think the message from Missed Apex to the LGBT community would be, we support you. We don't necessarily know how. You can tell us how, and we'll do whatever we can. But it hurts me that there are members of our racing community that don't get to enjoy the same freedoms that we do. Chris Stevens, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you speaking on what could potentially be a difficult subject. Go and follow Chris at Chris on Racing on Twitter. Chris, thank you very much.
Thanks, Spanners.
Hi, everyone. Well, that kind of ends the F1-y bit of the show. So I just wanted to do a little bit of listener feedback. But don't worry, if you tune out now, you won't miss anything. We'll see you back again for the French Grand Prix, and we've got a really exciting series of races coming up. So we've got a triple header, the French Grand Prix, and two Austria Grand Prix, so two races at the Red Bull Ring. And I want to make it a festival of F1 and podcasting here at Missed Apex Podcast. So I'm hoping that every single member of the Missed Apex crew will get involved and be on one of the shows over that triple header. And I'm planning to do a little shorter Tuesday stream as well, where we catch up on the news. Because sometimes when we do the race review on a Sunday, we don't pick everything up and we get frustrated on the Monday. We go, oh, if only that bit of information had come out, you know, before Monday morning. So that's what we'll do. We'll do the race reviews, catch up sometime midweek, I think Tuesdays at the moment, and hopefully get all of your Missed Apex friends involved. I hope you've not minded this kind of pre-record, since Missed Apex has become a very steady part of my life, and the weekends get very busy for me. It is nice to be able to do some pre-records so that I can, as I hopefully am right now, this second as you're watching this, on a beach somewhere in Essex. So we'll learn our lessons, we'll improve. We'd love your feedback on whether these pre-recorded segments, bringing a bunch of different people in and doing a bunch of different segments, works for you. Feedback at missedapex.net, and then me and Matt are spanners, or Matt at missedapex.net as well. So just a bit of feedback then. Thank you so much for your emails. I have a confession to make. I don't read or write so good, and my IT skills are very, very poor. So when I get a bunch of emails or a long email, I do get like a wave of like, oh my God, it's a wall of text, and I've got to respond in kind by replying with equal grace, yet these wonderfully written emails. So sometimes I will put them off, but I do read it. It's just that sometimes I get a bit like, ah, how do I reply? And if I reply back, thanks for the email, that is code for me saying I have read it, I have absorbed it, I understand it, and I appreciate it, because your emails really do keep us going. Your emails, DMs, kind tweets, sharing the podcast. I'll share a little bit more about that in a second, but I will say thank you to Ron Spars, who says, dear Mr. Spanners, no need to be so formal. I'm a long-time fan of your podcast ever since you invited Uncle Joe, and finally I found out I had mispronounced his name for a decade, Joe Saywood. So he says Saywood, S-A-Y-W-O-O-D. He's wrong. It's Saywood. But, you know, he can say his name wrong if he wants to. I decided to email you when I saw your tweet about 12,500 people joining the live stream. Yeah, that was amazing. That was for the Monaco Grand Prix. I mean, it shows that a lot of the F1 marketing goes to Monaco. I hope a lot of those people who tuned in for the Monaco Grand Prix stay around. And looking at the statistics from the Baku race, it does look like a lot of those new people hung around. So that's been a lovely welcome boost for us. Then I read your tweet about the Dutch commentary. Oh, yeah. I've seen the Dutch commentary for the first time. I'm going to say the name wrong, so I won't try and guess, but there's the guy who's been the main Dutch commentator for ages. Mol? Something? Olaf Mol? And he's a personality, but when Verstappen crashed out, he didn't hide. He's like, nay, nay, nay. He was really, really emotional about it. And then when Hamilton went off, he's like laughing. He's like fully laughing. He's like, oh, you dumb, dumb. Oh, there you go. Boom, boom, tickety boom. Bye, bye, bye. Ta ta. And it's like, wow, that's the actual Dutch commentary. So he says, as a Dutch guy, I agree with you. Because I just said, hey, if that's the level of the Dutch national commentary, no wonder, you know, a lot of the Dutch fans are a little bit passionate and get behind their driver in a certain way. I don't think there's anything against that. People say you shouldn't just support your country's driver. Nah, it's sport. The default is support the local sports person. You don't have to be an idiot about it, but that's a nice default. It's fine. I was born in Colchester, so I'm a Colchester United fan. I was lucky that it just so happens Colchester United are the greatest football team the world has ever seen. But I could have been born somewhere else. And even if I had been born in Gillingham, I would have probably been saying, oh, they're the greatest football team ever. It's just a nice default. And they're your team. You're the good guys. Everyone else is the enemy. That's just sport. Don't take it so seriously. You have to realize 90% of the people, I think he means in Holland, are just watching because a Dutch guy is racing. the commentator and after show are completely catered towards that audience. I can understand that. Every sporting nation, when they get someone who's really good in a particular sport, a bunch of people go in and support that. And maybe they don't initially have like a more nuanced understanding, especially if there's partisan commentary, like I saw on the Dutch TV link. And I didn't watch the whole race, so you tell me if that was unrepresentative. At Spanners Ready, I shared the clip. If you go, oh no, he's not normally like that, he's normally super chill, then that's fine, I'm listening. But yeah, you know, people wade into it, and it takes time, maybe for those fans who find it brand new, to, I don't know, develop a nuance or find other people in the sport that they like, for example. We have the same, completely the same issue with Lewis Hamilton fans. So I'm not, this is not like an anti-Dutch thing. Exactly the same thing with just rabid Lewis Hamilton fans, where everybody else is the enemy and only Lewis Hamilton is a viable candidate for deity status in F1. And as much as we get criticised for being Hamilton fans, we have criticised Hamilton for every mistake. We expect more from Hamilton. We expect more from the people that we support. Look at the last race review. Perez picked up his first win for Red Bull, and I'm sitting there lingering on poor grid start, you know, bad Saturday, because I want more. That's sporting fandom for you. Casper also writes in, hey, Spanners and team, normally I never provide any feedback to any of the podcasts, but I just want to say I enjoy the shows. But for a while, I feel the need to share my view on some of the discussions as I'm enjoying the show a lot. On the Hamilton-Perez bias, oh, I didn't plan that, but it's talking about what we're talking about. It's not a bad thing. You can be passionate about it, and often it's meant as a joke, but by apologising for it, you actually put more emphasis on it, allowing people to notice. Fair. Maybe I do. Maybe I should just have those biases and not talk about it, but I like the fact that you can judge my reaction and my opinion, knowing that I go into a race hoping that Perez will do well, hoping that Hamilton could do well, hoping that, believe it or not, Grosjean as well. I was Grosjean and Magnussen fan as well. And then you can judge what I'm saying in that context. I think that's fine. Somebody on a YouTube comment was criticizing me, and I said, well, who do you support? He said, they responded, why does that matter? And I went, I want to know. I want to put it in your comment in context. He goes, no, I want you to judge my comment on its own merits without knowing who I support. And I don't agree with that. It's a bit disingenuous, isn't it? You can listen to some other outlets and some other broadcasters where you can see an unadmitted bias. And over time, when you realise that, oh, in every situation where, say, Vettel is involved or Stroll is involved, they happen to be anti that driver. And you go, wow, they've really got an issue with that driver. You can see it on the Sky broadcast. There is one presenter who has a particular dislike for another driver. When it's easy, when it's a general thing, they always say that driver is good. But every single time there's a, could it have been their fault in a crash? Could it have been their fault in a wheel contact? They always subtly come down against. But that's an undeclared bias. You don't know. And I would rather like just say, hey, I've got a problem with that driver, or I'm a supporter of this driver. You can judge it in that context because it's fair and it's honest. And I encourage everyone on the panel to say who they support. It's not a problem in other sports. It's not a problem in football. For whatever reason, in F1, you're not supposed to say that you are a fan of whoever. To be honest, it only ever really is an issue if you say you're a Hamilton fan. People don't tend to get grief for being a Leclerc fan or a Vettel fan, for example. Thank you for your email, Casper. Joan Tobias says, hi, Spanners. I just wanted to say that I'm a relatively new F1 fan from the US, and you and Matt have really built a fun and informative program. Thank you very much. And we've got one from Gerald DeWitt as well. I'm very sorry to read on Twitter the abuse you've received in previous days. It's fine. It's been fine. I, as a Dutchman, have been thoroughly enjoying your podcast for several years as an integral part of my F1 experience and hopefully for years to come. And there's also one from Daniel Ellis as well. Hello. I just wanted to thank you for producing such amazing content, even in the off season. Thanks very much for that feedback. I'm going to try and get better at addressing it, replying, and also featuring it on the show as well. It's important, the feedback that you've given me over the years. It really is important, because when people find us, so let's say 100 people find us I hope that 10 people will go, oh, that's good. He's all right. That's my jam. I will carry on. I will carry on listening. I will subscribe. And even if 90 people don't like it, it kind of doesn't matter because over time we build from those 10. 10 more, 10 more, 10 more. Sometimes it's been 10 people found us and we get one. One more, one more. That's how we've built our audience. And I can be myself. When you're an independent podcast creator, you can and should be yourself and let the people who like that and appreciate that stay, and let the people who find that irritating, which by my feedback is a few, then you go find something else. It's free. If I was a Sky presenter, I would only turn up, 2 out of 5 spanners with my spannerisms. I would play it straight. And in fact, I am a mainstream broadcaster on a network, and I service that platform when I'm a part of that network. So I speak, act, behave as somebody who has to appeal to a broader audience because, those people are, say, for example, paying a subscription fee or paying a license fee. So you have to appeal to those people. But if you don't like me on Missed Apex Podcast, you've lost nothing. It's free. You just go and listen to For F1's Sake Podcast or something like that. Where it can kind of hurt is where we find 100 people, 10 people like it and hang around. Everyone else bogs off. But one person out of that 100 decides it's not enough to just not listen. They have to try and give me a kicking on the way out the door or leave a horrible iTunes review or something like that. And that has the potential to eat at your confidence. I'm used to it over the years, but I got a bit upset this week because one of my panelists said the level of negativity we've had in the live stream, the YouTube comments, and on Twitter has made me, it's put me off doing the podcast. And that hurt. That really hurt. And that's why I reacted angrily from the Missed Apex account. And that's why we'll be doing a bit more of a blanket ban hammer on negativity, because the panel don't deserve to feel like that. They're nice people, honestly. All of them are nice people. I only keep nice people around, or people I think are nice people. From my point of view, over the years, it can sap my confidence in what I'm doing if someone is saying, you are doing it wrong, you're bad. And for 6-7 years now, I've had a drumbeat of people telling me, I will never have a career in presenting and media. I will never build an audience with Missed Apex Podcast because I do X, Y, and Z wrong. Or I don't do it like other people do it. Or, I'm bad. For whatever reason, for whatever thing they've got irritated with about me, they decide to write lecturing emails, DMs, tweets, telling me I'm doing it wrong. And the reason that I am able to have the confidence to go, actually, I think we're doing something right, is because of, I would say it's four figures, the amount of people at least that have got in touch with emails, DMs, positive iTunes reviews, and I can wrap all of those around my forearm as just this shield of steel against people telling me that I should stop doing what I'm doing. I'm only continuing doing what I'm doing because of the support we get from you guys. And so I just want to say thank you. I want to say thank you to everyone who's taken 5 minutes out of their day to write an email, write an iTunes review, send a nice tweet. You really have kept us going. So thank you very much. I just want to address a couple of the common complaints I get. One is interrupting people. So sometimes it can seem like I'm interrupting my panel. I never want that to be a case. But lag can be an issue for that, especially with Joe. Ugh. So with Joe, we've just got enough lag that he will pause and I'll go, he's stopped talking now. I'll start talking, he'll continue, and then it looks like I've spoken over him. I do spend a lot of time trying to edit and trying to change that because people complain, oh, you're interrupting Josh. Oh, no, I'm not trying to. I'm just trying to keep the conversation flowing. Sometimes I'm actually rescuing one of the panel because it looks like they're struggling and I can see like a panic develop in their eyes that they've taken themselves down a conversational cul-de-sac. And interestingly, one of the hardest things to do when you're a panelist on a show, it's easy to start your point. It's easy to make your point. Ending a sentence is actually reasonably difficult. It's a skill. So sometimes I just get in there and I save them. And sometimes I'm just interrupting them because they're rubbish. No. So sometimes it is just because I've made a decision on flow. I'm not trying to oppress people or keep them down. I don't think there's any of my panel that believe that they don't get to say what they want to say. In fact, we spend a lot of time talking about the tone and the pacing and the back and forth. And hey, it's okay to give up the talking stick because trust that it will come back around to you. And we have a pretty good system of doing that. All right, then. So thank you very much for listening to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm leaving the shed now and donning my shorts, my little triangle handkerchief hat, some flip-flops. And in fact, I will tell you that we are not traveling light. We are taking a beach trolley with a hammock, with mats, a picnic table. No, not picnic table. But we are not traveling light. We're going to have a very as luxurious as we can trip to the beach. And it's my first weekend off, believe it or not. It's my first weekend off since July 2020. It's been a hell of a year. So looking forward to that break. And I'm looking forward to seeing you for the French Grand Prix. We're going to chuck out 6 podcasts in 6 weeks, a carnival of podcasting. Until then, guys, I would say to you, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.